This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it is our week in review. The theme this week, painful transitions. From a full reopening, even as we try to crank up the numbers of fully vaccinated Bay Staters.
There are a number of reasons why folks who haven't gotten vaccinated haven't.
So will $25 market basket gift cards make things practically better, morally worse? Also, painful resistance to a more diverse state GOP. New allegations from an openly gay Republican congressional candidate against a committee member from his own party. Here's candidate Jeffrey Sosa Paquette speaking to Channel 10.
What she was seeking was to find anybody, using her words, God willing, that will primary him. After all, I hear he's a married homosexual man. That sickens me that he adopted his children.
Then, in Boston, what's been a saga between acting Mayor Kim Janey and Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White threatens the labor secretary in Washington. White, in a video statement, says Marty Walsh knew.
I mentioned that I had a restraining order put on me with false allegations that I threatened to shoot somebody.
While White's family fractures in public, ex-wife Sybil Mason first spoke to WBUR, then told Channel 5 he should be fired. And no decision yet from acting Mayor Kim Janey.
I will make it as soon as possible after careful deliberation.
So let's pick it up there. And listeners, we've been following this messy mayoral and police commissioner transition for a while. Has it become something different this week? We've got increasingly ugly back and forth between members of the White family. Is this issue still policing and police leadership? Is that what is at heart of it now? And is it time for accountability for what he did or didn't do for Marty Walsh in appointing Dennis White to the commissioner's role? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our panelists this week are ready to go. We have Seti Warren, executive director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Institute of Politics and former mayor of Newton, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Seti, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Ed, welcome back to you too.
Good to be back on, especially with Seti.
So I'm going to start with where we are on this story. The hearing happened this week, and then Commissioner White's ex-wife broke her silence. And I'm going to give you some sound. She spoke first to Allie Jarmanning here at WBUR. Didn't want to go on tape. Subsequently, did so. Here she is speaking to WCVB Channel 5.
You see this scar right here? You see that? That was from being dragged out of the house because I wouldn't do what he wanted me to. That was being dragged out of the house. As I'm holding on to the door, trying to hold on to the thing, a nail caught me there. If that's not abuse and being pulled by your hair and stuff and trying to get your face burnt on a stove, if that's not abuse, what is?
And I want to note, we are going to continue to talk about this subject for the next few minutes. It's troubling content. We will have other cuts and quotes. So if this is something for you as a listener that is triggering for you, or you're concerned about others around you hearing it, be aware this is our content for a little while now. Seti Warren, I'm going to turn to you. We are reaching a point where this feels important, but also like it's shifted it was always dark, but there's something here that has shifted this week. As a former mayor, how critical is this crisis to the functioning of a city and its police force? And does it need to stay front and center the way it is right now?
Well, I think it is a critical moment. And, you know, before I jump into some thoughts, I do want to acknowledge two things. You know, as we get into questions about leadership and things like that, And I know you've said this over the air, you know, these allegations are so serious, and I know none of us will trivialize them. Domestic violence, there's no place in our society. But look, as a former mayor, here's what I know. Number one, this period for mayors across the country, not just the city of Boston, is unprecedented. We have a scenario where we're recovering from a worldwide pandemic. We are facing racial reckoning right now in our midst, and we should. And there are demands for change. This is right in the middle as Mayor Janey has taken office. And that's what being a mayor is about. It's the unexpected. You know, people vote and elect mayors because they have faith and confidence that a chief executive will instill faith and confidence in the city and these institutions. And she faces a critical moment. Number one, you know, she's got to deal with this really incredibly important decision around the commissioner after hearing the evidence. And number two, which I think is incredibly important in regard to faith in the institution, is what she does afterwards. You know, what are the measures in place that she believes need to be in place of accountability, standard practice, so that something like this doesn't happen again? And thirdly, you know, there is a huge question of policing in our society right now and how police conduct their jobs. So she's got to answer that. But I think the first two are incredibly important for the city of Boston right now, and certainly for her tenure.
Ed Lyons, we have talked about this story a number of different ways. SETI just touched on the fact that this is happening in the context of an unprecedented year for mayors. What other lessons will reverberate in other cities and towns in our Commonwealth as a result of what's unfolding in Boston here?
I think it's a reckoning. I'm not shocked by any of this. When we talked about this months ago, when we had only a glimpse of this, I said at that time that I was not optimistic this would be anything other than terrible, because the police are always covering up for their own, and there's a different set of rules for them than for regular people. So I'm not surprised at all that this is exactly what had happened. I think it's a reckoning in the past. It's saying that in the past that a lot of people weren't held accountable for their behavior, and our politics simply prevented that accountability from happening instead of making it happen. And so Mayor Janey is stuck with a situation she did not create, but she has to resolve it, even though she was not responsible for this happening. I think it's unfortunate that she came across a situation that she couldn't deal with decisively right away by removing him from this position. But unfortunately, because of legal battles and her only being acting mayor, she was not able to dispense with this quickly, which was unfortunate. I think too much of the conversation has been taken up with this. I think she should deal with it quickly and move on. But I do think that there are a lot more rocks that haven't been turned over. My guess is there are a lot of people in the past who got away with things, especially with the police, who were not held accountable. And we must have the determination to settle these things instead of pretending that there aren't going to be any more of them.
So SETI, Ed there is talking about, you know, issues that run deeper. One of the things I was thinking about this week on this story, you know, if you think in terms of solution sets, sometimes you don't have any good options in your solution set. And I wonder, is there a way to get this quote unquote right at this point? Or is this just a messy one that we make our way through as well as we can and deal with the aftermath?
You know, in my experience, this is an opportunity. This is a window of opportunity. I think Ed has it right. And every single mayor and town official should be watching this, because there are variations of this story that have gone on around the country. Look, this is an opportunity to go back and really dissect what went wrong here, going all the way back to multiple allegations, the commissioner's assent, to his appointment and how his appointment was made. I mean, this is an opportunity for Mayor Janey to really open up the books here, make this scenario transparent, and then put in place measures of accountability and transparency. I think there's a window. And I think that everyone from the media to residents of the city of Boston, residents across the country, want to see this. They are demanding this at this moment. So I think Mayor Janey has an opportunity to do that.
So, Ed, I'm going to play you a little bit of sound from the Boston Globe's Adrian Walker earlier this week. We had our own reporter, Allie Jar Manning, on after she had a conversation with Dennis White's ex-wife, Sybil Mason. And then we had Adrian on afterward, and he was talking about what needs to happen for the city. Here he is.
A couple of weeks ago, she talked about appointing a commission to look into reimagining policing, which was sort of a cover for appointing a search committee. I don't think she should do that either. I think she should appoint an interim commissioner and leave the search in its entirety to whoever wins the election in November.
So Ed, there's a lot in there. Of course, he's talking about acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. There's a lot in there that we could pull out. The piece I want to pull out right now is the idea that there's also multiple stages to this, and one stage of it can't happen until after a mayoral election. Do you agree with Walker on that?
Yes, I'm a huge fan of Adrian. I think his writing on this has been excellent. I think that this is not going to be a short-term fix. This is a long reckoning. There's no quick way to smooth this over and make this right and get back to business as usual. There are going to be more cases like this. And correct that Acting Mayor Janey did not have the power to resolve this quickly. That is a warning that perhaps, dealing with this decisively before selection might end up not working out. I think he's right. I think she should appoint someone in the interim who will do the job correctly, and then leave the official appointment until after the election, when somebody will come in with the full power, will have the mandate, and deal with it more decisively. But to Seti's point, that I think it's time that she start, as other mayors start, to think long term, that I'm going to keep seeing these things. How should I behave? How do I get the public out of the, oh, we'll just fix that, and then we'll move on, go back to normal. No, we're not going to go back to normal. There's a long reckoning here. This is a marathon for justice. It is not a sprint, and we should not make it out to be a sprint that can be won quickly.
So, Seti Warren, I'm going to turn back to you about former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. As I do that, listeners, at this point, is there a moment of accountability coming for former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh? Do you think that should happen? And if so, what do you think it should be? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Seti, I'm guessing based on that, you can kind of ask what direction I'm going in as I turn to you. You know, he suspended Dennis White just days before his Senate hearing. I was surprised at that time that he didn't receive any questions about it during his confirmation hearing. But now, I mean, you've got Congressman Seth Moulton saying that he may have to resign if he did, in fact, have knowledge of White's history. Boston Globe columnist Joan Vanacki writing that this should matter to President Biden. Are we seeing those grounds shift, and should we, in terms of former Mayor Marty Walsh's responsibility here?
It's a great question. I think about this in two ways, in similar ways to what Mayor Janey is facing. Mayor Walsh, Secretary Walsh, the question is there trust, faith, and confidence in the Office of Labor, and will there be moving forward? I think two factors are at play. One is he's got to really be clear and concise about his role in all this. And second, and you alluded to this, his former constituents, the people in his hometown, will have great influence, I believe, on what happens in Washington, whether they have confidence in what he's done and what he's saying. I think that will be a huge factor in what happens moving forward to Secretary Walsh in Washington. But I think he's got to, I think he's just got to be clear and concise about his role. I think that's incredibly important right now.
So Ed Lyons, I wonder if there isn't some continuum that goes from honest mistake on one end to dereliction of duty on the other end. And if we, accept for a moment that hypothesis that there's this continuum, where does this fall for the labor secretary?
I don't think it matters at all. If it was maybe 10, 20 years ago in a different American politics, perhaps, where you could easily get cabinet secretaries confirmed and where it was calmer time, perhaps this would matter. But politics is simpler and less nuanced than we would like it to be. The reality is that the people that went down to Washington thought correctly. They're trying to save America. The country is in terrible shape. The pandemic, 4 years of hell, a failure of institutions to get confidence amongst the public. We're in a very, very terrible time. Everyone in the cabinet is there saying, I'm going to save the country. No one is going to care whether or not that Secretary Walsh knew something about a police commissioner. Honestly, there are people in labor all across the country who have poor working conditions, who are not making enough money, who need things, and Walsh is either going to deliver for them or he shouldn't be in the office. I don't think there's any politics where he sort of pays some sort of a price, not based on what's going on. I don't like saying that, but I think it's reality.
And Seti, so Ed's making a practical, not a normative argument there, but should people care about the role that Marty Walsh played here?
Well, they should care to the extent that this question of trust and faith in institutional leaders, they should care. I think that's just a general statement, and it goes back to how Mayor Janey can handle these challenges and gain confidence actually in a role. Same thing for Secretary Walsh in his role. I think, you know, one of the concerns I have in general is this sort of sinking view of government and government officials. So I think it's important. Again, I think he, you know, as information continues to come out, I just think he needs to continue to be concise and clear about it. And that's all he can do.
Still with us, Republican political writer Ed Lyons and Harvard Kennedy School's Seti Warren. Listeners, let's talk about one full week into the reopening. How did you feel? How did it go? Did you try new things? And I mean, you're probably talking about that at home, too. But collectively, let's understand, collectively, are we in a moment of worry? Are we in a moment of happiness? Are we in a moment of nervousness? Is it all of the above? Where are we as a collective? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Seti, Ed, do you feel like we have entered the new normal? At one level, that's a simple question, but at another level, it's each person's temperature taking of how far out of the worst of this pandemic it feels like we are. Ed?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the new normal actually began about 4 or 5 months ago in terms of sort of how people behaved and how much traffic there was. But there was something to this about the restrictions going away, Baker's emergency powers being over in days. It feels like we won the war. So I feel like I'm celebrating, it's wonderful, but like a war, you think about the casualties, you think about the damage, you think about all the mending that has to be done. So for me, it was a whole bunch of emotions about joy, about, you know, just mirth at the celebration, everybody, but also realizing some friends of mine are not in good shape mentally, and that a lot of people lost their jobs, people have died, people have long haul symptoms, and that there's a lot of people to be tended to, despite the fact that I feel like celebrating.
You know, you raise so many important points there, Ed, in terms of the complexities of everybody's individual experiences in this moment, too. Seti, we had some great calls throughout the week this week, and I want to play for you Molly, a parent who called in earlier this week.
I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old who are not vaccinated, so we have a mixed household. And I think it's really hard for my kids to see so many adults without masks on. Our kids have had such a tough year that now they have to wear masks when, you know, they're older adult, many times role models aren't. It's a little confusing, and I think it's really hard for our kids, and it makes me feel frustrated because they're people too.
So, you know, one foot in one space, one foot in another. Families who have different vaccination statuses, different abilities to wear masks and have freedom of movement. And in fact, countries where we will eventually be going back and forth, having an entirely different experience of this pandemic than we are right now. So how are we supposed to orient ourselves to this moment? I mean, little question for you there, Seti. How do we orient ourselves to this moment?
No, it's important. And I agree with Ed's commentary. I mean, when I think about this question, I actually think about disaster recovery. And my role years ago as a Federal Emergency Management Agency regional director, you know, you have this really harmful catastrophic event, and it does two things. One, when that event happens, there's an immediacy of keep everyone safe. But then as recovery occurs, you can see the unevenness in society. And it's really glaring. And so, you know, when I think about as things open up, I think about exactly what you've both covered, which is there's an unevenness about this. You know, some of the points for us to think about, and there's a lot of questions. When we think about this question of going back to normal, you have many more people of wealth that actually had the opportunity to stay home during this pandemic. There's a huge disparity there. There's huge disparities in quality childcare that were in place before the pandemic. And I saw some statistics this week where, as of last week, only 550 Massachusetts childcare providers had opened their doors, down from 687 before the pandemic. So you've got quality, affordable childcare that's a difference as things open up. And what does that mean for employees? What does that mean for employers? So there's just many, many questions. And I think as a society, as we view this through our own lens, I think we need to be thinking about neighbors, people we know, people that we don't know. And I think to Ed's point, the last point, is there's been a ton of loss that's been in our midst. Some people have known people, other people have watched this catastrophe occur. So I think there are a lot of questions that are yet answered. And I think we would be prudent to take a step back when you think about mm-hmm. The people we work with, the people we know and we don't know, and our approach.
Let's go to the phones here. 1-800-423. Oh, we just lost our caller. All right. So, Ed, I'm going to pick up some sound from another caller earlier this week. And it gets to this idea of the different experiences we're having in this moment. This is Gordon in Malden who called earlier this week.
I got COVID and was hospitalized in the end of March. It's really no joke. I lost 30 pounds in less than 3 weeks. And if you think that's some glamorous thing, you know, you're more than welcome to suffer your way through it. It's really hard to imagine that all of a sudden all these people are just getting back together and that there's no consequence for that.
So, Ed, you know, there's this solidarity aspect, right, that people's need, their own social, emotional need, mental health need, practical financial need, et cetera, to get back out into the world. And then there is this tie we have to each other to respect and honor both the challenges people may still be having if they are still sick or unvaccinated or part of a particularly vulnerable population, or just honoring the loss or the pain or the experience they've had. And I want to talk about that a little bit. What's the solidarity we show in this moment, even as we all try to regain a life we knew before this pandemic?
I think what the pandemic gave us was sort of a context to put everything in. I mean, Massachusetts has always had a lot of inequality and injustice and people suffering and dying and not getting what they deserve or unequal outcomes. And I mean, the huge home equity buildup of all of us who own homes is not fair at all. But that happened even before this. I think the pandemic gave us a container to put it all in. People looking at it and saying, there are so many parts of the human experience that happened in a thing we can talk about, which is the pandemic. It gave us a way to say, all points of you are welcome because we have this solidarity around what we went through. I worry that when the pandemic goes away, that we'll lose that container and then we'll just go back to accepting inequality, injustice, suffering, and all kinds of things because we no longer have a context with which to address these things.
Let's go to the phones here. We've got Sarah on the line in Stoughton. Wait, the number is 800-423-8255 if you'd like to join this conversation. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi. I would just like to say I'm someone who's been very apprehensive about returning back to quote-unquote normal and, you know, wearing my masks, only seeing friends in small groups outside. And I worked at a wedding. It was outside. Everyone was seemingly vaccinated. I was double vaccinated. And for the first time, I kind of let my guard down and had fun with these people. And it was very refreshing. And I just think it's a very interesting place. Like, Massachusetts is doing fantastic. And to toe this line of, do I need to stay apprehensive and on my toes, or can I do what everyone else is doing?
Sarah, thanks for that call. And Ed, I just want you to know, in the back of my head, I'm still running through what you said. There was a lot there, and I think we're going to come back to it. But because of Sarah's call, Seti, I want to pick up on this idea of where we are with vaccinations. She's saying people got two shots, or they got, you know, we can assume probably some of them got one shot with J&J, and she could let her hair down, and it felt differently. And she said that, you know, Massachusetts doing great. Here's Governor Baker this week explaining why we're not doing better than we are. 53% is great, but why we're not doing even better.
Some folks haven't gotten vaccinated because they've had COVID. Some folks haven't gotten vaccinated because they're young. Some folks haven't gotten vaccinated because it hasn't been approved by the federal government formally. And some people simply are concerned about the fact that nobody does know really the answers to any of the so-called long-term questions associated with vaccines of this kind because they are new and they were developed relatively quickly.
So the rubber meets the road there. Here we have Sarah providing the view of this is what it feels like when you're vaccinated and you can let your hair down. But we have folks who still are worried. What's the hard work to do right now to get those numbers up, Seti?
Yeah, I think it's community-based. One of the and also we have to recognize there is such a wide variety of rationale as to why people are not doing it. I think Governor Baker started in on some of those things. Just two quick things. Dr. Ashish Jha, who I know you've had on recently, tweeted out an interesting stat, and that is in Newton, and he puts out these percentages, in my hometown of Newton, 99% of people over 30 have been vaccinated. In Springfield, 64 of people over 30 have been vaccinated. In Springfield, 12% of kids aged 12 through 15 with at least one shot, 64% of kids aged 12 to 15 have been vaccinated. These are huge disparities in two communities, Springfield being one of the largest cities in the state and Newton, 11th largest. But there's reasons why when you look at the underneath some of these numbers and you look at the survey data, there are some people that don't have transportation to get to a pharmacy. There's some people that are busy. They have inflexible family or work schedules that may prevent them from taking time off to get the shot. Some people are worried about, you know, sort of the after effects of the shot and them not being able to take time off. So I think that the hard work, and you had Michael Curry on a little earlier this week, I believe. I agree with Michael. This is really strong community-based engagement, communication, coming from folks that know each other, and then also making sure from a city and state perspective, we're taking barriers away, as many as we can, if it's transportation, if it's people not being able to take time from work and you know being paid for that. I mean, there are some state intervention, but it's really community-based. I think that that's the work that needs to happen.
So it's interesting you raise that, and I do think this comes back in part to what Ed was saying before, SETI. Ed, when we did the vaccine incentives conversation with Dr. Jha and Michael Curry earlier this week, they both really argued in the short term, incentives might put some shots into arms, but in the long term, for real commitment, we need to have real understanding. And I think that ties back to your worry, Ed, about do we forget what we know in these moments if they don't settle in for us in really deep ways? And so I guess that raises the question of what conversations do we need to be having with each other and ourselves over and over again right now so we don't forget what we know the pandemic taught us, Ed.
Yes, and let's not forget that there's unequal public health outcomes in many issues all over the state. I mean, I guarantee if you compare Newton to Springfield and anything with public health, there'd be differences. So I don't really think we should expect the fact that the pandemic will be different than every other public health effort that we have been having going on for 100 years in the state. So, you know, I think that it's about culture fed by demographics, by education, by politics, by many things. There's so many reasons why people get vaccinated or don't get vaccinated, but culture is sort of the intersection of all of those things. I've lived next to Newton half of my life, and believe me, they have quite a culture there. No matter what public health effort you offered that was a good idea, people in Newton would be all over it, and I praise them for that. But I think that as the context disappears, as the pandemic is seen as something more like the flu in terms of the model, the danger, and everything else, and less like what we saw a year ago, I think it will look a lot like other lopsided public health efforts. Right? I don't think we have very much time before the public begins to say, oh, this is like getting your flu shot, and what's the big deal? I think the time is running out for there to be some sort of urgency with this that will be different than other public health things that we want people to participate in.
All right, I'm going to go to a break, Ed Lyons, SETI Warren. Stay with us. But listen, before I go to a break, I've been given an update on a breaking news story from this afternoon. Two Braintree police officers are being treated for injuries following a shooting. The Braintree mayor's office just released a statement saying that the officers were responding to a report of a domestic incident this afternoon in the area of McCusker Drive there. And according to the city, the suspect ran into some woods, was taken into custody. There's no official information yet on the condition of the officers. This is something that WBUR News is going to keep following. You'll hear more about it later this hour and All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock. With us still this hour, SETI Warren, head of the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Ed Lyons, Republican writer and activist. Listeners, we're shifting gears, and we are going to talk about serious local tensions within the state Republican Party. Are we seeing transitional pain as the party moves to the right and more fully embraces former President Trump, resists fully embracing former President Trump? Let's talk about it. How is that playing out in your community, and what do you see as the future of the GOP in the Commonwealth? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to dive in with the basics here. Jeffrey Sosa Peckett is running for Congress in the 2nd District. He's Republican, gay, married, with 2 adopted children. Now, Debbie Martell, member of the State Republican Party Committee, expressed religious-based disgust, which is her word, over the adoptions, first in emails and then to the candidate when he confronted her. A range of elected Republicans, including Governor Baker, Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido, have condemned her remarks, called on her to resign. State Party Chair Jim Lyons has remained silent. I'm going to start broad on this, actually. Seti Warren, general reactions to this situation.
Well, I will probably defer a lot of my time to Ed on this one, because he probably has a lot more insight into the machinations of the Republican Party of Massachusetts. But here's what I would say, 2 things. I'm glad that Governor Baker and Lieutenant Governor condemn those statements. I think that's an important statement to make, no matter what party you are from. So I'm very pleased with that. But the second thing is, to me, this is a trend that I'm seeing happening, which is the nationalization of state and local politics across the country, which has been growing. I saw it in my own city of Newton here. It was a recent city council race where, if you were to read the articles around it in the Post, you would think this was a race that was happening down in Washington between the various factors of the sex of the Republican Party and Democratic Party. And it's concerning. It's very concerning that we are at this state from a broader perspective. And I think some of this does come from where we get our news and how we get our news. One point, and then I'll let Ted jump in. You know, when you have 53% of people saying they get news from social media, that is a huge portion of the news that they get versus from years ago. And a lot of that has to do with local newspapers and outlets going away because of finances and the like. But it's of real concern in regard to governance and public policy and politics.
So I want to ask listeners, it seems like the question on the table right now is actually, is there room within the 2021 GOP in Massachusetts for a gay married candidate? Is there? And if there's not, what does that say about the state of the party here, given where we've come from, given the fact that we were the first state in the union to legalize gay marriage? What does that mean? 1-800-423-8255. And Ed, I want to give our listeners some of the sound here. Here is candidate Jeffrey Sosa Peckett speaking to Channel 10 NBC Boston about what the head of the Mass GOP, Jim Lyons, told him when he raised concerns about the language used by the committee member.
As a proper Republican, I must stand up and do my part to say this is unacceptable. His answer to me was he wasn't going to get involved in inter-party politics. And I said, inter-party politics? You're the chairman of the Mass GOP. Are you not supposed to be running the party?
Ed, this feels retrograde. And the silence, should I be surprised by this silence? It feels stunning.
First, Seti, you were great. I think he really got to what is driving this. Of course, this is a disaster. You have to be just astonished that the bigots in the party would synchronize this with the opening of Pride Week. It's the kind of anti-branding that they've become very good at lately. I'm glad everyone's condemning it. I think really in this state, all of our elected officials, state representatives, mayors, the governor, of course, lieutenant governor, locally, kind of don't like this and don't support this and are tolerant or supportive of gay rights. This is an outlier position. But the reason why this has happened is because that the party a few years ago has decided it's just tired of trying to compromise with our state politics and has decided it's going to represent a national politics or Republican agenda from somewhere else that is not in any way trying to compromise or answer to gateway issues in this state. And it's very unfortunate. Republicans like me and Jeffrey and others and the governor who, you know, want to proactively and productively engage with issues, you know, housing, transportation, all kinds of things. But we recognize that there's a civil rights consensus in this state, and the state party as an organization is no longer interested and opposes that. Jim Lyons supports this. That's why he didn't say anything. He agrees with the state party platform is that only straight marriages count. I mean, this woman's getting in trouble for blurting out the party position. So this is not a shock, but it's more important to diagnose why this is happening.
Ed, I have to ask you, because I actually don't know. Was that a loose interpretation, or are you literally saying that the state party platform actually has that as a plank in the state party platform?
It is. I mean, it was come up with years ago. It was reauthorized in 2018. It's saying that the party values traditional marriage. And it was very clear the fact who that was excluding. I asked the platform committee last time saying, can you get rid of this? And I said, no, we're going to keep this because, you know, the compromise is keeping it instead of adding more anti-transgender stuff and all of that. So the party does not support gay rights as a small organization of people. While I think most Republicans support it and our elected officials support it, this is a question of the fact that our state committee is kind of talking to themselves, which is unfortunate.
I'm going to grab a call here, 800-423-8255. Megan's on the line in Watertown. Megan, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that there is no reason across the country why we should not have gay elected officials, but especially in Massachusetts, the Republican Party needs to get with what the people of Massachusetts stand for, and that is inclusivity and not exclusivity. It's sad.
Thanks for that call, Megan. Now, Seti Warren, as I turn to you, I want to be fair. Here is Mass GOP State Committee Vice Chair Tom Mountain also speaking to Channel 10 NBC to their reporter Allison King.
I told her, you must resign. It's over. Goodbye. What she did was wrong. It was immoral. We don't have any room in the party for such things. And I'm not going to put up with it since no message was forthcoming. Then the vice chair has to step in and fill the void, and quite frankly, do the right thing.
Have you spoken to Jim Lyons about this?
No, he never returns my calls, and I'm the vice chair.
So I don't want to soften this, Seti, by saying, is this just a question of a leader? And I think Ed's made a very clear point that he doesn't see that it's just an issue of leadership alone. But it is remarkable that even the vice chair and the chair of a state committee in a small group, in not a huge state, aren't even returning each other's calls. I mean, are we watching the dissolution of the infrastructure of the Republican Party here in the state?
It's a great question. And again, you know, it's good hearing my neighbor there, Tom Mountain, in Newton. But look, this is a national conversation from my perspective. This is not just a local conversation. This is the kind of conversation that I see happening across the country. You know, what are the values of each of the parties, Republican Party and Democratic Party? What do they stand for? What is the direction in regard to things like, you know, LGBTQ rights and civil rights and the like? So I don't see this as a state question. I see this as a national conversation.
So, Ed, that brings to mind the fact that we actually had former Vice President Mike Pence up in New Hampshire yesterday. I'm just going to play the sound to start.
January 6th was a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. But thanks to the swift action of the Capitol Police and federal law enforcement, violence was quelled. You know, President Trump and I have spoken many times since we left office. And I don't know if we'll ever see eye to eye on that day.
So that agree to disagree message is striking, given that we're talking about an attempted insurrection in Washington on January 6th. I hear Seti saying what's playing out here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is the same as what's playing out nationally. And then we hear Tom Mountain and Jim Lyons not on the same page. We hear the former vice president and the former president not on the same page. How well can a democracy with a two-party system withstand this kind of internal struggle in one of those two major parties without those structural issues also becoming part of our democratic challenge?
I think a lot of things have changed in American politics over the past few decades. I think in the past there were corrective measures. I think the media was different. I think the political culture was different. Our campaign and finance system was different. There are all these structural problems that are making us pay a much higher price for problems in our politics than in the past. I even see how national politics dissolves town politics, never mind state politics, that mm-hmm. we're getting kind of nationalized. We're all getting very angry about things. I see people taking their national political anger and applying it to tiny issues at the municipal level. I don't know if we've ever had such a problem with that, where people are divided because they're so used to being divided. So I think the Democrats are getting heavily affected by national politics also, but they pay a smaller price for it in Massachusetts. So it's not as noticeable as what's happening in the Mass GOP. But I even see in the Democrat side, there are Democrats insisting that all Democrats be a certain way because of what they're hearing from outside Massachusetts, when there's actually great diversity of Democrats in this state, which I view as a positive thing. So I think our politics is in trouble for lots of different reasons. And we're just seeing all the effects of it here in Massachusetts.
So, Seti, let's pick up on this thread that Ed just gave us of national politics dissolves town politics. Over the last few years in the greater Boston community, I consistently hear from civic organizations, local leaders, that the solution to healing is to stay local, to focus on what we can do together with our neighbors. So it's alarming to hear this idea that our national divisions can begin to dissolve those local ties. As a mayor, where do we turn to re-strengthen, a former mayor and somebody who's run also for statewide office, where do we turn to strengthen those local bonds again, neighbor to neighbor?
Well, I think we have to recognize, and Ed alluded to this through the last hour, there are really deep, very deep disparities right now in our society, whether it's in regard to race, whether it's in regard to where you grew up. And now we're talking about, civil rights and the like. We have to recognize that and be truthful about, some historic intentional decisions that have been made at the local level. When you think about redlining and housing, when you think about, segregation in our schools, when you think about, who is running some of the leading institutions, in our state, all of those things, who's at the table. We've got to recognize all that. We cannot ignore those things. And then as a community, we can't see it addressing it as a zero-sum game. Heather McGee just wrote a fantastic book called The Sum of Us. And her basic premise is, all these things are true that I just said, but over time, when we talk about addressing some of these disparities, folks react to it and say, oh, I'm going to lose something if I address some of the racial inequities. I'm going to lose something if I do something about desegregation. And that's just simply not true. And we have to dispel that. And I think we can begin to do these types of things at the local level. And finally, I just want to say, you have a whole generation of young people who, are looking at their future and they're very upset and they're very angry. They're looking at where, a lot of older people have left the planet in regard to climate. They're looking at the fact that they're saddled with debt. Many of them haven't even finished higher ed. They can't buy a home. They barely are able to rent and save. And they want to demand structural change. And a lot of this is also being driven at the local level. So I think as leaders, we have to embrace the fact that there are some truths out there. And then we have to find ways not to divide one another, but make sure that folks don't see it as a zero sum to address these things. Because frankly, if we do address these things, our communities are stronger. And all the data shows that over time. That kind of work can be done locally.
Ed, that makes me think of a conversation we had on our air earlier this week with Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards, talking about housing affordability. And the first question I asked her was, is it a linchpin issue for sort of stabilizing and growth coming out of this pandemic? And her answer was, it's not a linchpin issue, it's the issue. So there's a place we could work on together. Do you see possible common ground across elected and sort of civic society leaders across party divides here in the Commonwealth to gather on something like housing affordability and find our bonds by moving forward on a statewide issue like that?
I'm not optimistic. I'd like to think that, but having seen some local housing issues, even here in Governor Baker's hometown, I don't see positive signs. It is seen as a zero-sum game. Seti is correct. In the long term, it isn't, but somebody says, oh boy, I don't want this ugly apartment building on my cute little street here, and I'm against it, or my property values will go down. They don't see the greater prosperity, and they don't realize the price they pay for the status quo in ways that are not obvious to them. I don't know if we can do much more locally. I think the politics has sort of failed in a lot of places. My guess is the state has to have a much stronger hand in forcing housing while there is a statewide conversation on the need for it. So I think there are very hard politics ahead for housing, and I'm not optimistic, but it's going to take the state having a stronger hand, in my view. The towns just simply won't do enough themselves.
All right, I'm going to take us now to Hubbubs. And I just, for listeners, we did also take a quick look. The latest we could find was 2018, to Ed's point, which does include language in support of traditional marriage. We always try to double check those things and see if we can find the latest information. Ed, you're right. 2018 was the last that we could find, too. All right, let's turn to Hubbubs. Those are our end of the week local stories that caught our attention. Oh, we've had a heavy one. So let's turn to the hubbubs and see what we've got there. Seti, what's your hubbub?
You know, mine is the decline in trust in institutions, governmental institutions like the CDC and businesses and otherwise. It sort of, you know, for me, ends where we began, which is if people don't trust their institutions, we'll actually do something about the things we've just discussed, the inequality, the, you know, just massive barriers for success in our society for swaths of people, that trust will continue to erode and we'll be in a dangerous place, particularly coming out of COVID. In this survey, we're surveying people about why they weren't getting the vaccine, and this was part of the reason. So we've got to look at this in the eye and as a society address it.
We've got a worker ahead of us. All right, Ed, what do you have for a hubbub this week?
My hubbub is a small thing. I think that we've all suffered through the past school year as parents. I've certainly seen it with my children. The state government released the composition of all the different kinds of students in Massachusetts for the past year. And I think it's interesting. A lot of people changed schools, did all kinds of things, so much wreckage, but some innovation along the way. I noticed that the number of homeschoolers in Massachusetts, people who have chosen to stay at home, not the remote thing we all did for a year, but who are not using the system, went from several thousand to more than 17,000 the past year. And I think that's a really interesting thing. I used to be a homeschooling family, and we may go back to that again soon. We probably would have this past year had we any idea we'd be remote the whole year. We probably would have sort of given up and homeschooled. But that community is a great source of innovation that can be adopted by others. So I'm really looking forward to see what all these new homeschoolers are doing and educating their children.
All right. And for me, I have a hubbub too. You know, I think I'm a sucker for animals. There is this story playing out on the Esplanade this week that I just find so fundamental. Two swans, and people had been celebrating them and their six babies. And then earlier this week, the Esplanade Association announced that the mother died. And the father swan has been a single dad caring for these six cygnets. The pictures in social media have been incredible. Him carrying them on his back, him wrapping his wings around them while they sleep. And this sense of this father finding his way forward with these six baby swans, there's something so universal about it. I just really connected with it. So check out the pictures on social media. They're really something. All right. Seti Warren, Executive Director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School, former mayor of Newton. Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks for reviewing the week with us.
Thanks so much. Thank Great to be with you, Ed, as well. And
Great to have you both. Listeners, that's the show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening, and do join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.